Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk. Today's guest is someone who keeps himself very busy doing a number of things, and I'm going to start with introducing you to Ralph Crowder. Ralph is a filmmaker, he is an activist, he is a speaker, but for today's conversation, let's focus on just Ralph. Ralph, where were you born? And welcome to Mind Talk.
Well, thank you for having me on the show again. It's always good to talk to you. And again, I congratulate you and the Mind Talk staff for keeping very consistent for needed conversations that deal with our mind and hopefully how we can get it together, right?
That's the plan. We've been doing it for a while now.
That's right. I'm sorry, what was the question again? I'm sorry.
Tell me where you were born. What was your life as a little one?
Yes, yes. Well, I was born in the home of the New Confederate North, Minneapolis, Minnesota. I was born to Ralph and Frances Crowder, couple that had a union after they met each other at Hampton Institute, now Hampton University. And I would definitely say that I'm a child of the movement, that powerful movement of the late 1960s to the mid-70s. Some would term that as the Black Power Movement, Black Nationalism, Pan-Africanism, that kind of train of thought. So I'm a product of two strong parents that I think... along with a broader community, extended family, imparted some real critical values that it seems that we need to kind of reflect on those values and maybe, like I said at the beginning, you know, get it back all together, because I think we're losing ground on a lot of issues that we see today.
I noticed you referred to your hometown of Minnesota as the New Confederate North.
Oh, yes. You didn't know that?
Say more about that. Say more.
Yeah. Well, you know, let's see. I think the facts are in. The data is compiled. This area of the country here that many would think is a enclave of... liberal thought, the home of Hubert Humphrey, for those who might go back a little bit backwards in the history. But it's amazing that you could have such a low concentration of Black folks here at the top of the country here, right on the, you know, the state is bordering Canada. You know, I would say we're probably, you know, 7%, 5-6 somewhere of the total population, but very concentrated in the cities of Minneapolis, St. Paul. Ironically enough, you know, the per capita income for a Black family in the state of Minnesota, with again the focus on the core cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, it's actually lower than the state of Mississippi.
You're kidding.
Oh, no, I'm not kidding at all.
You wish you were kidding.
Yes. So, you know, I'm one to believe that the relationship with white liberal institutions and environments that kind of pride themselves of being progressive, liberal kind of realities with their relationship to the Black community, I'm one to believe that that is maybe one of the most dangerous things that you could have, that really, I think in the long term, it's a kind of slow process of falling asleep, if you will, of your own self-determination, and the purpose that we should all have to number one, be owners of our own mouths, what comes out of our mouth, and therefore be then owners of the institutions in our community. So I think Minneapolis, this particular state, has a story to tell, and I definitely believe that the relationship, like I said, to that identification of progressive liberalism is something that we have to look more into, because I really don't see that working in favor of the black community at all.
That's interesting, because, you know, Minnesota is generally seen as sort of the land of general wonderfulness, with lots of clinical interventions and clinical innovations that have really been helpful and adopted worldwide. So I think it's really interesting and important to get the view of someone who, you know, sort of is on the ground and living in the place and in the space. Tell me about the early values that were instilled in you by your family, friends. What was important to you growing up?
Oh boy! Anybody who's familiar with that particular time period, and you know, again, that would be like the 68 to 75 movement, knows that if you were one to really be a part of pushing forward in any part of the new awakening of black identity, black thought, black movement of that particular time period, knows that that was a very difficult process for a lot of families to sustain, not only their relationship to another in terms of the adults, like a marriage relationship, but the impact that that particular struggle and the attack really that was launched to black America at that time. You know, it's interesting, we're hearing even corporate white media admitting now that the Nixon cabinet and the drug war was basically designed to attack the black community. I mean, through the issue of framing the drug wars as kind of pushing against this new movement, this new awakening, I feel, in the community that threatened the core of the status quo of American structure at that time. Interesting enough, we're still dealing with that. But, you know, I really think the value systems were a continuation of the ongoing black thought of freedom. I mean, that particular era was nothing new per se in terms of black people and our journey in America and abroad, you know, to define ourselves, or in many ways redefine ourselves and continue the quest of rediscovery of who we are and where we came from. You know, a lot of us have an indoctrination that's contributed by our public school system that reinforces the narrative, the slave narrative. But as we all know, we definitely are far greater people that have contributed to much of world civilization, and that's documented. But that particular movement and that value system, again, that I believe I was a product of, is something that, again, needs to be studied. You know, these children that came out of that particular movement, I don't think it's any irony or any I don't think it's an accident, put it like that, that you saw the crack wave that happened in the mid to late 1980s.
Okay.
Into the early 90s. These children that came out of that era were attacked again in the second wave of the drug wars, if you will. If we didn't exterminate you from 68 to 75, we're definitely going to get the children. And,
you know, Ralph, you know, as you're talking, I'm hearing many things that were instilled in you growing up that are, I would say, so much a part of what is critical to remain healthy and whole as a human being. It sounds
yes.
like certainly the quest and the appreciation and the awareness of freedom versus not freedom was an important piece that you grew up with. But I also hear that you grew up learning to question, learning to analyze, learning the value of history and research. In fact, critical thinking seems like it was very much a part of what you were taught. It sounds like in your home as well as the broader community. Does that seem okay?
Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am. My father is a retired professor of history with an emphasis on African studies at University of California, Riverside. And, you know, him and a lot of his colleagues at that time, you know, once again, the movement was all the way from the streets, you know, to the halls of academia, and into the political realm. You know, this year is a reconvening of the Black National Convention in 1972 in Gary, Indiana, a monumental moment where that particular movement met the influence of you know, the national politics at that particular time. So, yes. You know, those things were instilled in me on a daily basis. I was that little baby that, and I talked to a lot of my friends and the people who know me, you know, and even some of extended family members that grew up with me and, you know, kind of worked our way around our parents around this era. You know, a lot of us felt like we didn't even have to read books, you know what I mean? Because we were the little babies in all those conventions, conferences, community meetings, you know, you name it. So the oral history was definitely imparted. And at that particular time, you know, reflecting back on that youth era, you know, that's something that you kind of, you probably took for granted, and you didn't want to be there at those particular times. But you know what? I'm so thankful, and this is for the parents out there today. Those things that you expose to your children, believe me, they are strong, powerful influences. And I would rather be exposed to countless conventions, conferences, community meetings, and so forth, than sitting around watching TV or listening to music that's not building my mind. So I was blessed to have parents and have a community and have that particular movement of that time that really instilled some very important survival tools for me as I sit here today, being 45 years old in America in the times that we're dealing with right now.
Ralph, what took you to the root of becoming a filmmaker? I mean, I hear all that. I mean, certainly the history was rich and vibrant and alive. Why film? I mean, there were so many things that you could have chosen to do. Again, mm-hmm. Why film?
You know, I think film and media is a very important, and I think it really simply boils down to when you feel that you don't have a voice, you become voiceless, and then you're in a position where you can really be misrepresented and oftentimes taken advantage of because you don't have a voice. And, you know, just kind of like the term community leader, you know, you don't hear white folks talking about who their community leaders are. I mean, I think that's a really interesting term, and it's a term that's appointed, I think, to a lot of people in the Black community, because we do suffer from not having our voices heard.
Interesting.
And so the communication platform of media or film or the arts or anything that is able to kind of use our experiences, our energy, our vision, and to actually have that come out through our voice, and that voice being heard by multiple different platforms of technology now, I think that that's an extremely important thing. And so I happen to be in a situation at a particular time as a parent in public schools where my children were actually going through something that's not too uncommon for Black children in public schools here in Minneapolis. It's ironic that across the street from Minneapolis Public Schools headquarters is a huge billboard, and it says 77% of Black children in Minneapolis Public Schools are not reading at grade level. This is not anything new to any urban public school setting at all, but my children were a part of an experience much like their peers, where their service of public education was not an experience that was equal to their white counterparts. And as a parent, discovering and going deep down into the federal and state laws of funding per child and how funding goes from the state or federal government to the school, the public school administration, and then on to the individual schools, I begin to find out that, wait a minute, this money isn't following the children.
Right.
And when I move to advocate as a parent, as we all should, when we see that things is not taking shape for the best interests of our children, especially in the public institutions, when I move to advocate around that, I begin to see that other people were in a position where they were speaking for my experience many times, and many times they were actually contracted or paid by the institutions to many times protect the corruption that was at hand with our Black children. And so when that started happening, I began to get into a whole new world of understanding that importance of basic survival skills, of learning how to advocate for yourself, the value of the written word, reading, and learning how to communicate your thoughts in public or in private, and then therefore moving to establish a media outlet specifically for parents that were dealing with these particular issues.
Interesting. So the first entree, or an early entree, was really about educating parents as to what their goals, as to what their rights were, and what they could do to advocate for themselves and their children.
Yeah, in this on this side of maturity, yes. I think earlier I was definitely involved in hip hop, and I did, you know, do things that were related to, you know, promoting shows and having hip hop video kind of things, and, you know, producing things that were more culturally related to the music and the culture of hip hop. But on this side of maturity, as a parent, yes, I moved those skill sets to actually transfer to how it could relate and how it could be a niche in the needed information for parents at that time in public school settings. So yes, that was my, I would say, entry into things that weren't necessarily specifically culturally related around music or mm-hmm. the arts per se.
Ralph, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue this conversation. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk and a conversation with Ralph Crowder, a filmmaker, and so much more. chose film as your vehicle to speak and to share. And, you know, I often get really concerned about, at least in my view, the fact that too many of us have no true clarity about the power of film and communications and the various communications tools that are available to us. What's your thought about that?
I agree with you totally. You know, I mean, the reality is many of us, we don't want to be talked to, lectured to. We have enough difficulty just having relationship with or fellowship with one another right now. You know, we're dealing in an era where our families are broken, our communities are broken, and the institutions around our families and communities are broken. And so obviously this is going to have a huge influence on how we have relationship and fellowship with each other. So I feel that I'm a visual or audio kind of learner. I don't know. I have a value for that. I don't think my attention span is one that likes to sit down and read books upon books upon books, you know. And there's something that's, again, like you said, that's powerful about film, the arts, or the way that media can be used in many different platforms, that presents an opportunity for people to just kind of sit back and absorb energy in their own space and come to their own conclusions on whatever they're absorbing, whether that be visually or through the listening, through musical vibrations, or even through communication of what we're doing right now. I think we should really tap into as many tools to communicate to our people as possible.
So let me ask you this, Ralph. Let me ask you this. You use the media, multiple platforms in ways to communicate. Okay.
Yes.
Now, the things that you are communicating in large measure, in addition to the cultural information and the cultural experience, as you just described, you know, you were really also delivering advocacy information. So the media then, just as a whole, there's no roadblocks in the media, right? There's no racism in the media. I mean, you're able to use it to do all these wonderful things, right?
Was that a setup question?
A little.
No, you know what? Fortunately, we do have somewhat of an access. Now they're trying to change the speeds and, you know, the internet frequencies and who pays for the higher package, you know, coming up. And, you know, there's a lot of things that are going to be happening with tapping into that independent space of internet access. But you know, in terms of our more traditional sense of how we are able to produce and distribute media, that definitely is a reflection of where we see ourselves in the experience of what we see from the police down to the public schools. Our public institutions are nothing but a reflection of our day-to-day lives, and they are governed by people, and many times those people are invested in the outcomes of what we see, the unfortunate outcomes of what we see of black pain for profit. And so when we begin to create this media and begin to try to find avenues or platforms to distribute this media, I no doubt we experience many different issues around systemic institutional racism, blatant discrimination, and a lot of times we even have to deal with our own people's role in that conversation and how they may benefit from the legacy of that particular structure of what America has been built on. It's not limited to just white folks. Let me just say that.
Okay.
You know, black folks participate in these unfortunate realities, and many times black folks their sense of survival is connected with this. I think for some reason we've lost faith. You know, black folks tend to be a people that have a very close relationship with God, whatever God we serve, whether that be Muslim, Christian, or the Jewish faith. But it seems that we've lost our faith to think that money has become the God, and our faith is not moving our ability to produce miraculous signs that God is able to break through all kinds of barriers. I think we wouldn't be here today having this conversation on the phone if God wasn't working in the best interest of black folks, because our mere existence here today is nothing but God. I mean, and so I'm one who has faith. Let me just put it like that. I mean,
okay.
I know there's different people that might go a different direction in that. But I'm one who has faith, and I'm one to look at the journey of black folks in America as being unexplainable in how we can still survive among the many obstacles, the inhumane experiences that we've been a part of for years. So,
let me ask you this.
Yes, go ahead.
That's all right. Let me ask you this.
Yes.
You used a word that I think is critically important that many people don't understand the urgency and the power of. And the word was distribution. You can create anything, everything you want to. It can be the best anything, everything you've ever done. And if you don't have a path to distribution, it's sitting there staring back at you. Now, in that regard, I'd like to move over to the Minneapolis Television Network, because you had an experience there. You had an experience, speaking of distribution, Public Access Studios, which, when we think about public access, it's for the community, it's for the public, it's a place where the public is provided access to the airwaves. So, what happened to you?
Well, I mean, what happened to me is no different than what happens to black folks across this country. Look, these, when we think of, and this is maybe the most immediate way that we can actually communicate through these airwaves, either through television or radio, public access.
Or internet.
Public, yes, and public radio, for that matter.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Our public institutions that are funded by the public are designed specifically to house opportunities for those who produce media, period. And many times our public access airwaves are even more designed to have a more of a concentrated effort to appeal to the voices of quote-unquote disfranchised communities. And this is through federal and state law, and through the different charter agreements that corporations have with city governance. So, for example, if Comcast or Xfinity Cable is in, let's just say, Bowie, Maryland, or in Minneapolis, Minnesota, in this particular case, Well, the corporation does business because these airwaves that are going to be exploited by the corporations for their interests, they have to allot a certain amount of space for the public to have access for these cable lines. That is basically what you use to watch, you know, BET or CNN or whatever, cable television. And so these particular access stations are designed to give the public a voice and a relationship with this cable telecommunications lines that these corporations exploit. And what happened specifically more in Minneapolis is, like I said, I don't think it's any different from anywhere else in the country, where the people that, many times the people that run these institutions are not a part of the community. They have some kind of oversight that is a relationship with the city governance. And so if your city is not doing its due diligence by the black community, then I'm sure that the people that are selected or elected to work on behalf of these particular public access organizations, they're going to be pretty in line with the city's priorities.
Well, let me ask you this. Let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. You know, you're talking about public access television.
Yes.
Public access.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in my world, which may clearly be only my world, there is a certain responsibility that a public entity has to behave reasonably well in the service of serving the public. And, you know, Ralph, I'm looking at some photographs of a public access program in which there are five men on the stage, and it happens to be five white men on the stage, and they're drinking, which to me is kind of odd to put that on television. And they are, one of them is, I don't even know how to describe this, there is a African-American woman who is bent over, her rear end is exposed, and one of the men is touching it with something. I don't know what he's touching her bare rear end with on television.
A paddle.
Okay.
Yes.
On television.
At 7:30 at dinner time.
I'm speechless.
Well, but you know what? you know, when we, you know, I talked to my brother earlier, who is doing an excellent job helping keeping Mind Talk moving for the public, for the people, and we talked about Francis Cress Wilson's memorial just recently. And a sister made a comment that when we accept the unnorm as norm, that's the definition of insanity. And we have a duty to actually be strong, liberated people, free people, to stand up when it's time to stand, when we see things that are wrong. And to the spirit of the elder Frances Cress Wilson and the work that she did, you know, we have become so oppressed that we've accepted so many unnormal conditions as being norm for us because of there's a fear, and usually fear is present when you lack faith, that when we do stand and we call out these institutional issues that definitely interface with public accountability, and public funding, many times off of the backs of black people, and all these disparities that you know, we keep on studying and talking about. But the reality is that we have to be willing to stand when we see things that are wrong, period.
And we also have to, because, you know, part of my concern, in addition to the five guys on the stage drinking on air and paddling the bare rear end of a woman, is that the woman is there. I mean, if she weren't there, you know, they couldn't do it. So the need to be very clear for ourselves, I mean, talk about unacceptable, right? I mean, I've been ending the program for years with, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. This was jaw-dropping for me. And yet,
well, you know, on top of that, Dr. Brewer, the deal is in how we juxtapose that particular issue with this public access organization, again, was they gave permission for that kind of programming, which was a live program at that particular time.
Oh, gosh.
But they denied me and others that look like me, black folks, the same kind of access for access and support of this particular organization. They denied black folks and black producers access for organizational support for live programming and live events, but allowed that particular example. And that's nothing new. You know what I'm saying? The inequalities, the blatant discrimination around racial lines and things of that nature. But what's interesting is how we are involved with that, meaning the black community. And many times we move to support those kind of organizations when there is some kind of level of contracting or funding that maybe they use to keep these realities as normal. So, for example, after we called them out for their behavior and their lack of accountability to black producers, black media, etc. Interesting enough, they moved to contract with Black Lives Matter, and also a local organization that promotes, nonviolence in the community and stop the killing and things of that nature that has a city contract.
Ralph, and I'm going to interrupt you. Give the audience an opportunity to sort of chew on that for a minute. We're going to come back in just a moment. But, you know, the thing that really strikes me as, well, there's so many things about this particular situation that strike me as odd and reprehensible. You were trying to do a news show. That was not okay. But having a naked woman on stage while everybody's drinking and paddling, that's okay. Okay, we're going to take a break. I need a break. We'll be right back, and we'll continue this with Ralph Crowder. I'd like to move on to what you're doing now and your hopes for the future. But before we go there, the Minneapolis Television Network, they were so appreciative of your taking the time to document these reprehensible actions, and they applauded you for your efforts and your sensibilities, yes?
You know what? Let me just say this. Well, actually, you know, I'll tell you what, their executive director isn't there anymore. And all their board members that were on the Minneapolis Telecommunication Board that were identified as being progressive, white liberal, left-leaning kind of figures in the community, they all resigned except one. So, you know, as we move to speak and stand on these issues and add some light to those dark places, there have been some things that have happened in that particular organization that have changed some things temporarily, but it needs more. I'm one to say that it needs definitely more attention and more scrutiny. Because I just want to say this. Look, Dr. Brewer, we met actually in D.C. when I was screening a film I did called Hands Up, Don't Shoot Our Youth Movement, and I would just probably say that, you know, and this is not to puff my chest out, but we've traveled the country and exhibited some of our media materials and been well received. We've just got back from Chicago, Illinois, with the WVON in Chicago, a staple in the historic black community and in black radio, period. So, you know, I believe that, you know, we've exhibited some level of visibility around our work. But my interest is for that young brother or sister that walks into any public access facility that feels like their voice, or maybe the next parent that feels like their voice isn't being heard, and they are in immediate need for to vent or to document their particular experiences and communicate to any given audience that they choose to do so. And if just put it like this, if that happened to me and I could document it every step of the way, what is happening to I don't know how many black folks that are looking to express their thoughts, concerns, or their views on any topic when we enter these public institutions? Because it's not just about public access.
Right.
We also have to deal with institutions like National Public Radio and their affiliates in every city. We have to deal with the Public Broadcasting Corporation, which is also another entity that is federally funded to have this kind of access for our community. It's interesting that Sesame Street started as a result of the unrest in the black community, right? And these kind of programs were kind of targeted at black youth of that particular time period. And if those in your audience know, Sesame Street has just been lifted off of the Public Broadcasting Corporation, and now it's housed at HBO. Now, that's an interesting thing, because I don't know, maybe there's some issues that, you know, when we deal with low-income kind of communities and the realities of some of us are just trying to keep up with our cell phone bill if right. we're able to do that. Many of us don't have constant access to internet. So these public venues and institutions of media is imperative for the black community to really understand what our rights are and what our role is to ourselves to produce and create media that's designed to speak to our issues.
And to support these outlets that are trying to do exactly what you said.
Yes, and we need to support them by holding them accountable to what they're supposed to do in our community. You know, when we fall asleep and begin to think that, you know, let's just say, cable access is nothing. It's just kind of like a place where people do some funny shows that nobody cares about. Well, I'll tell you what, cable access is one of the only institutions where anybody can go right now today and literally produce a show and talk about mainly anything that you pretty much you want to within the realm of, you know, kind of you know, language and so forth, you know, there's some other issues around that. But pretty much you can go in any public access place or any place that's a public radio station, for that matter, and produce a show. And that's your outlet for your voice to happen. But guess where we are? We're sitting in front of CNN and MSNBC and talking about how come they're not talking about what we want them to talk about. How come they let go of so-and-so as the news anchor? How come, you know, they're portraying Ferguson or Baltimore or Chicago like that when we know there's a different story that should be told? Well, guess what? It's on us to get up and tell our stories for ourselves and use the existing spaces and platforms that we have available to do that.
Are you willing or interested in accepting stories from people around the country who have had difficulties with public access?
You know what? I'm absolutely interested in hearing some of those experiences. Interesting enough, the city of Chicago that I told you that we just came from for a screening that we did, there is a brother there who has moved to actually have his own studio, and he's taken the next step. Most people that interact with, you know, kind of like public media platforms or, you know, public radio or public access television platforms, we go to their studios and we record and produce, you know, our materials in that particular setting. Well, this particular gentleman in Chicago, he moved to build his own studio, and he was telling me that the public access organization in Chicago has been basically shut down for remodeling, I believe, up to a year now. And so just imagine what kind of impact that's had for people that depend on those spaces to produce their particular shows.
Right.
And there's definitely an impact in the community where those voices are now not being heard, and there's inconsistency around that. And so, yes, there is a listen, black folks died for this. You understand what I'm saying?
I do.
We died for this. You know, we stood in front of hoses for this. We many of our elders got bit by dogs for this. Many people have died for this or in jail or whatever. You know, there's rights that we earn, not were given. We earned through many times our bloodshed. And one of these particular rights around federal and state oversight around our public institutions and access to media and access through media outlets are protected. And so we need to hold those things accountable. There's an interesting lawsuit right now that kind of deals with something like this, but it's a little different. Byron Allen is suing Comcast Corporation. He's also suing Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson, and the Urban League and the NAACP because of the issues that I just told you about. When I said, you know, interesting enough, when I was experiencing these issues in Minneapolis, they moved to hire and contract and give opportunities to Black Lives Matter and a community spokesperson that has a violence initiative business that contracts with the city.
Okay.
That was their role to kind of maybe incubate themselves with quote unquote community leaders.
And shut you down?
And maybe take the attention on the issues that I was raising.
I see.
In terms of the you know, not being accountable and blatantly breaking policy and procedure and out just blatant racial discrimination. So they moved to contract these particular kind of, or hire these particular people to make a statement of, we are in good standing with the black community. See, we have Black Lives Matter, and this gentleman over here who does the nonviolence program for the city of Minneapolis. Okay. So basically, Byron Allen right now is suing Comcast Cable for $10 billion.
Wow.
He's suing, and a part of that lawsuit is also suing Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson, the Urban League, and NAACP for their role of being kind of the buffer between the corporation and their responsibility, and they were getting contracted and receiving monetary donations to basically partner with these corporations as to be kind of the voice of community support. So if Comcast is literally breaking the law and their responsibility to provide equal opportunities to black media companies like Byron Allen's, but they're moving to contract in kind of a monetary way with Al Sharpton that opened up the door for him to be on MSNBC and so forth, kind of looks like they're already in a good standing in the black community because they're working with stakeholder or historic black organizations that say that they serve the community. But many times we'll end this suit from Byron Allen. He's saying that those organizations were doing business with Comcast, but they weren't being responsible to the legal law of Comcast's obligation to black-owned media businesses.
For those who are unaware of who Byron Allen is, can you just give us a quick sense of who he is?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, the brother is Byron Allen. He's been he started as a comedian and a writer. If you kind of stay up late at night, maybe around the 2:30 hour or something like that, Byron Allen has had programming on various television stations for years, like your ABC or your NBC networks, okay. Where his programming, I believe you might be familiar with it. It's kind of, some of it is a comedian based and entertainment based, but he takes opportunity for those late night hours. So let's just say he can buy a block of time from your local ABC outlet from 2:30 in the morning to 3:15 or 3:30 or 2:30 to 3 o'clock. He can buy that block of time, and in that block of time, he can sell his programming to advertisers, right? To advertise in his program for commercial spots. Now his concern is that Comcast is not giving him access to be supported in the business of advertising to support his programming.
I see.
So that there's a big kind of issue around that. I hope that Byron Allen actually connects with different people across the country, and this isn't just probably just the thing that's about him, but he has a broad-based coalition of people that understand this kind of media obligation for corporations or public institutions, for that matter.
For those who are listening who are trying to figure out what first step they can take as an individual to begin to get his or her voice heard, do you have some thoughts or ideas?
Yes, speak.
Okay.
It's as simple as that. If you can't speak whatever your thoughts or ideas are, then you're not ready for anything else. And if those thoughts or ideas can't be articulated in public and in private, you know, then you might still have some work to do. Because the first step in doing anything is being able to speak whatever that is.
Right.
That's the power of the word. And once you are at that place, when you can vocalize whatever is on your mind, then you're on the right path. And I would also say when you not only speak it, but if you're a person that needs to write it. And then move to if none of this really takes a lot of money. It really just takes a lot of willingness to struggle and be consistent about moving forward. because there are community institutions across the country that are funded, again, to be there to help facilitate whatever you would like to produce in terms of radio or television or even the written word for that matter. So I would say if you can't speak it, then you need to think about why you can't speak it. And if you can't write it, then you need to think about, well, maybe I need to get some assistance because I'm not necessarily ready to write it either. But once you get to that place, then you, all you need to do, I would direct you immediately to your nearest, me personally, to your nearest public access organization in your individual city, because you can literally go in there for a very minimal fee to join. And there's a very minimal fee for classes that are designed for you to learn editing or studio production or whatever it is you want to do. And then work that harder than you would work your job. Work, be more dedicated to that than you would working a 9-to-5. Because if you're trying to build yourself, you better work harder for yourself than you would for anybody else. Because this is about your voice. And that's the only thing that you can control.
Ralph, I got to ask you, how do people find out more about what it is you're doing?
Yes, ma'am. You can find out more about Freedom Radio and Freedom Radio Television Network. And this is a multimedia platform that we developed through all these, you know, kind of the values of the conversations that we just had today. You can access our products and our media at freedomradioandtv.com. Freedom Radio and, that's A-N-D, TV.com. Freedomradioandtv.com.
Okay. Ralph, I have to thank you. The time has flown by. Something tells me that we will be talking again and again, because there's so much to talk about and there's so much for people to be clear about that they may be less clear than perhaps is useful. Thank you very much, Ralph Crowder, for spending time with us today here on Mind Talk.
Thank you, and I look forward to seeing you again, and thank you for keeping consistent and keeping the struggle for your platform, because we need it, and I just really want to lift you up too, and you're much appreciated, and your whole staff, and continue the journey.
Thank you very much for that. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is produced daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to take the place of any medical, mental health, or other professional you might choose to work with. Mind Talk is available on demand at myndtalk.org. If you have any questions or comments about today's program, you can send an email to Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. And again, that's mindtalk.org. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. And I just want to remind us all, if it's unacceptable, it is so unacceptable. You take care.